Hello and welcome to the Scottish Housing News Podcast with me, Kieran Finlay, and my co-host Jimmy Black. You may remember an episode back in April in which I asked Kirsty Morrison about the use of data connected to Fit Homes being developed by Alban Housing Society. We discussed the benefits of the information but also potential implications around who owns the data and how we can ensure that tenants are protected.
Now it seems fairly obvious that the more you know about the houses you manage, the people who live in them and the areas where you operate will be helpful. But is all that knowledge stored in the head of the housing manager who's just retired, or buried in unreadable Excel spreadsheets? Google, Meta and Amazon all know the value of data, and now the housing world is catching up. So we're going to explore how well-organised data can help inform decision-making across all areas of social housing, from creating sustainable communities to assessing the condition of our stock.
To help us with this, we have Daz Chohan, a senior data business partner at data specialist Housemark, and Dan Blake, the executive director of customer experience at Berwickshire Housing Association, who is also chair of Housemark's Scotland Advisory Board. So Daz, you heard Jimmy mention creating sustainable communities there. Can you define what they are and how data can help to create these?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Kieran. Now, in terms of how we're defining sustainable communities, there's lots of different areas of focus here. So affordable and adequate housing, having a sustainable community ensures that access to affordable and adequate housing for all of our residents. It provides a range of housing options that meets the diverse needs of individuals and families, including social rented homes, shared ownership, and affordable home ownership. Now, it promotes social inclusion by fostering a sense of belonging and community cohesion. A sustainable community focuses on enhancing the quality of life for its residents. It provides well-designed, energy-efficient homes with access to essential amenities such as schools, healthcare facilities, green spaces and recreational areas. It provides safety, security and a clean environment. For me, a sustainable community offers a range of supportive services that address the diverse needs of residents. And these services can include financial advice, employment support, childcare facilities, community centres and programmes promoting health and mental well-being as well. Now, the availability of these services help residents overcome challenges and enhances their ability to sustain their tenancies as well.
Okay, so a lot of information there, Dan, and I know that you're coming here with two hats on, your Housemark hat and your BHA hat on. So if Daz comes to you and presents that information, how do you use it? How do you look to implement it?
Yeah, thanks, Kieran, and thank you, Jimmy, for having me. There's lots there. I think if I can wheel it back to sustainable communities, I think a kind of semi-utopian perspective would be that we're meeting the needs of everyone in the community, that people feel safe and healthy and ultimately are happy within that environment. But even an even more simplified version for me is just that we're creating places where people actually want to live. Housing plays an integral role in that. I suppose the data that Daz is talking to there in terms of informing it and informing what we do strategically, there's a myriad of things that he's obviously covered there. But it's about, you know, assuring, are our homes quality? Do they reflect a good quality? Are our neighbourhoods and our homes safe and secure? Are we offering affordability? And do the decisions that we make in terms of delivering services reflect value for money for our customers? All of these things we have a role to play in terms of our contribution to sustainable communities, but we also have to do it in collaboration with partnerships. So Police Scotland, Scottish Fire and Rescue Services, Social Work, Commissioning Services, Health, Education, local community councils and tenants groups. So we have to have, the bit there that I would talk about around sustainable communities is, and Daz will be able to talk to this, I'm sure, is about data, this concept of data democracy and access as well. So how do we make data accessible to those, and how do we make sure that all key partners are seeing it through the same lens? That's a challenge, I think, around sustainable communities, is we're all looking at data and we're all looking at banks of data, but are we seeing it through the same lens strategically, and are we, you know, coalescing in terms of those outcomes that really contribute to making sustainable communities?
Dan, I see that you've actually been working with other agencies in the Borders Housing Network, haven't you?
Yeah.
And the way that you've presented some of the data that you've gathered to do with the activities there has been interesting. You helped tenants claim more than £2 million in benefits. And of course, you've been able to justify your project by revealing that statistic. I liked your stat, which showed that Berwickshire Housing Association's wind farm had generated enough electricity to boil 90 million kettles, which I think is more kettles than probably exist in the borders. How do you use data to support your work in the community then?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. 300,000 social homes in Scotland, Jimmy, so we'll be boiling kettles for a long time at that rate. But so I'll give you some key examples, because I think the next thing I would kind of want to talk about, the challenges with sustainable communities and our contribution to them are numerous. And, you know, that could be housing supply versus demand. Daz mentioned the quality standard issue and net zero decarbonisation, compliance, and then you've got the backdrop of rent regulation, affordability. So there's a number of things there. I'll take an example. We've used data. So we've went to stock condition, Berwickshire Housing Association, that is. I've done a full stock condition survey. Now, we aimed to do 100%. What we've achieved is 100% of all externals and 77% of all internals. What we've made sure is that we've not set the specification and methodology to include cloning. So every piece of that data is coming back and reflecting an accurate picture of the individual homes that we are responsible to. What that allows us to do is set real clarity in terms of our strategic asset management for the next 30-year plan, but it's also an anticipation of what we know will be more ambitious energy efficiency measures and targets. So, you know, we're not alone, and the sector has talked about this, it's been widely publicised. What's coming will be challenging for all organisations. But what we've then done, if we understand clear investment priorities, and that's where we then have to bring that data democracy back into the boardroom to say, are we focusing on fabric first to the detriment potentially of more aesthetic cosmetic improvements and investment like kitchens and bathrooms? So we have to have that conversation. But what we've done in specific relation to stuff like the fuel poverty effort with Borders Housing Network. So Borders Housing Network collaboratively, and this isn't the first thing we've done collaboratively, but it's one of the most recent successes. We've obviously drawn down the Scottish Government's Social Housing Fuel Support Fund. And in the first round, I think it was circa 450K, and that was distributed pro rata across all of the housing associations. What we've done is we've linked the stock condition data with EPC and EASH information that we have. We've also then linked a further piece of data, which was done by MMC Research, that was around our customer profiling and insights, to identify customers who were at risk of or in hardship, specifically with regards to fuel poverty. And what we've managed to achieve using that data is a targeted campaign whereby 217 households have received support along large fuel debts. So that's anything upwards of £1,000, 217 households in the Scottish Borders, and the average payment of those has been £684. So really significant stuff in terms of, you know, taking data around stock and condition, targeting it to a group, and then making sure that we have an impact. More so, we've also been able to distribute fuel bank vouchers to 3,273 households in the Scottish Borders, and that was to the tune of £154,000. And these are smaller vouchers, contributory kind of vouchers of about up to about £50. But again, once we have detected the need, we therefore can respond to that and react to that and then wrap around, you know, further supports, whether that be advice for ChangeWorks, who are also a partner in the Borders Housing Network, or indeed something that's a bit more profound around, you know, an investment in a replacement central, you know, heating system, whether that's air source heat pumps or what have you. But that's something that's been a data-led and a data-driven project, initiative, approach. And the collaborative part of that, I think, has been that we've been able to share our experiences, but we've also been successful as a consequence of the collaborative effort, because we've been able to target a whole entire region across the four housing associations. So something that we're particularly proud of. With regards to the wind farm, this was something that Helen Forsyth, former chief executive, certainly one of her legacies, And you know, we have a 2/3 ownership of that alongside CEST, and that I do think that that's something again that we're very proud of. It's an innovative, I think, initiative and project. It stands to generate income back to either allow us to develop more homes, and that addresses the housing supply and demand issues down here, which I could talk to in great detail as well.
Another one, Dan, we're talking about the Borders Housing Network, is the work together on domestic abuse. Now, all the things that you've mentioned there and domestic abuse, no one would argue that these are good campaigns and good initiatives to have, but how does data help validate this, focusing on the domestic abuse? Because not one that you'd immediately link to kind of, I don't know, hard data.
Yeah, so, and I mean, I'd be remiss not to reference the great work of the Chartered Institute of Housing and the Make a Stand campaign. Callum Hornchuk's obviously led that. The recent commissioned research, you know, policies, not promises, it's kind of a, you know, deeds, not words reference. I think from a data standpoint, there's some, I mean, our whole vision at BHA's revised vision was to realise the power of home. And I think that speaks volumes when we're talking about domestic abuse, because the statistics would illustrate that 87% of domestic abuse takes place within a household or dwelling. I don't think there's a statistic that could be more clear in terms of our role and contribution to that cause and to that plight. Borders Housing Network, alongside Scottish Borders Council, have had a long history of working really well in this area and in this space. Domestic abuse advisory service, DAS, was set up to be a resource for the whole community, but something that we could work very closely across the housing associations. And we noticed within COVID, and I think, you know, because working closely with the Violence Against Women Partnership, Police Scotland, Public Protection Committee, even down here in the Scottish Borders, we knew that there was a sharp increase in domestic abuse occurrence throughout COVID. So the responsibility, it's clear and evident for us to get involved and be I think first through the door and be the responders that try to prevent this and support survivors, victims of domestic abuse. What we're really eager to see, because we've done quite a comprehensive staff-based training across 323 of our staff, that's including DLO, on what the signs of domestic abuse are and also how we can support our staff and our colleagues who are suffering from domestic abuse, because I think all too often we overlook that these things take place across all walks of life and everybody can potentially be affected. So we start with staff teams going awareness from there. What we're then going to do is, and we're in the process of unifying a policy across all the network, and that will follow through again with an awareness raising campaign around procedure, referral, and key partners are involved in that. But yeah, we're very, very committed to having an impact, and the Domestic Abuse 2021 Act will hopefully allow us to have greater powers with regards to perpetrators. One of the things I would fully expect is, you know, homelessness presentation, we still talk about survivors or victims of domestic abuse within those kind of categories of presentation within homelessness being quite high and prevalent. The legislation, if it works and if it's understood by the judicial system, I would expect that the presentation would be through the perpetrator as opposed to the victim and the survivor within that setting, and that feels right.
Let's move on to stock condition and look at that in a wee bit more detail. Daz, I mean, damp and mould have always been huge issues and they're top of everyone's agenda just now. How are Housemark members making use of data to tackle poor stock condition?
Yeah, well, I think in terms of best practice, you know, how can data be used to improve stock condition? Well, I think from an asset management point of view, data can be leveraged to create, you know, comprehensive asset management systems that provide detailed information about each property. This includes data on property age, construction type, maintenance history, as well as stock condition assessments that Dan referred to earlier. Now, by having a centralized database of property information, you know, providers can start to prioritize and plan maintenance activities based on the condition of these individual properties. Now, the condition surveys are absolutely key to this. They need to be very regular. They need to be conducted and recorded in a systematic manner using robust data collection tools. Now, time and time again, I find that stock condition information is stored on spreadsheets, it's not systemized, and the information isn't getting to the people that need it the most to make an impact on the ground. The ones that I work with that have the most success is where a lot of the information is systemized, is automated where possible. And these surveys, they capture detailed information on the state of these properties, and they help to identify, you know, areas that require repairs and refurbishment or upgrades. And data from these stock condition surveys can help prioritize maintenance interventions and allocate resources and budgets efficiently.
The technology for improving stock is changing all the time. Is it about creating a framework, rather than saying that this piece of technology is the one that you should use? Is it about creating a framework that allows better decision making?
No, I think that's a great point, Kieran, and I think suppliers need to be held to account for the systems that they develop. Now, a standardized approach is what needs to happen across the board. And I know there's some work going on through various different authorities, as well as different private organizations, about standardizing housing data sets, data definitions, and applying robust data governance. But ultimately, what needs to happen is there needs to be a large subset of data that's collected through every condition survey, every interaction from a maintenance operative, a housing officer, anybody that actually visits the property as well. They need to be collecting a lot of information in a consistent way and having validation on entry. So when information is being entered into systems, it's being flagged if there's any gaps or any quality issues. That's going to have an impact on ultimately the tenant in the long run. Something that needs to be addressed by repairs operatives, or, you know, something that needs to potentially go into a major works program. All of that information needs to be going into the system consistently with good, strong governance around it.
Dan said that he isn't using clones. And by clones, I think he means that if you've got 100 houses of a particular type, you maybe just look at 10 of them and assume that all the others will be the same. Why are clones bad? Or are they bad?
Well, I think from my perspective, the cloning of properties was well ingrained in asset management strategies in the past couple of decades, but they are being addressed now, where cloning is coming across as it's not best practice, and individual people in their properties have different lifestyles that can impact individual building components, kitchens, bathrooms. And I think we need to have a more personalized and tailored approach to each property that our residents live in. So I think from that perspective, cloning does not work across the board.
Sticking with yourself, Daz, COVID obviously had a big impact on repairs and improvement programs, and some landlords have seen void rates go up. Empty homes are not good for anybody, and I see that South Lanarkshire Council have suspended non-urgent repairs to focus on bringing them void and empty properties up to a standard. Is this a practice that you can see replicated, and how can good data help landlords face with taking these decisions?
Well, I think during the pandemic, there was a lot of repairs that went into the backlog. There was issues with no access. There was issues with compliance as well. And we've seen that through the decline in the Scottish Housing Standard as well. We do need to prioritise our approach based on the data that we have, looking at the most urgent issues. There's finite resource that's available to do that. And also there's a lot of difficulties with securing contractors to complete the work that's carried out. So I think using the data that's made available, I think it would be prudent to ensure that the higher priority issues around repairs are being tackled first, but there needs to be a strategic approach to how the less important ones, or the ones that are a lower priority, are being addressed as well. But again, it's the contractor shortages that's having a big impact on that.
Yeah, maybe just coming there. Yeah, just on top of that, I mean, there's something that I can talk to directly from Berwickshire Housing Association. We've certainly experienced a significant increase in reliance on reactive repairs. I can't talk to the void side, because actually data would tell me something quite different, Kieran, and I'll maybe pick up on that. But from the reactive repairs side, our repairs have increased post-COVID and have sustained at that level. speaking to Jonah Thurgood, who's one of the data specialists and data manager at Housemark. We have regular kind of validation sessions, and we talk through data masterclass workshops. And Jonah has kind of been able to validate across a peer group and across the sector that that is a trend that does seem to be appearing. What we use in terms of data is we can get underneath the data and start to ask questions of, is it been because less planned maintenance has occurred? We're more reliant on the reactive because of the less planned maintenance. Is it because we've got, in terms of what are the numbers increasing in terms of the work orders, or are we talking about the labour shortages and material cost increasing, and that's hitting the bottom line as opposed to actual a tangible number of repairs we're doing? So we can get into all that detail and start to really analyse it. There's other questions around, we regularly review void spend. Is the void spend lower, and therefore the reactive repairs are occurring after the void and after the tenancy has started? These are the types of things we interrogate from rich, mature, and data that's been good integrity checks, as Daz says, integrity as it goes in. That's the type of stuff that's helping us understand these unhelpful trends in some ways across reactive repair service. From BHA's standpoint, though, also using data, we understood, and sadly this was the case, we understood that customers were, when they were accessing, our operating model had a lot to do with some of the way that customers access service. And we did a survey on all this, and this data then fed back and allowed us to make changes. So we had a call abandonment rate of 40% at times coming into BHA, which stands to reason that people aren't getting through, aren't reporting repairs, and maybe apathy sets in, I don't know. But we've improved that. We also they had a chance of maybe talking to six or seven different teams about something. Now, a customer doesn't call in to speak to seven different people. They call in to speak to an individual with maybe seven different issues. And our customers are no different to us, as we expect services. So we had to fundamentally change the model. And we've now got a customer experience team. Everything comes through into that team. It's a designed one-stop shop where we try to get as much of a response, or certainly task out stuff to services and requests at that point. But that has also driven a higher amount of repairs, because people are now getting through and now being able to report the repairs, and news travels fast. So there's loads of things, and data can inform it all. And I think it's just making sure that we are interrogating the data, and we are actually genuinely trying to make better improvements to our services so our customers' experience is better at the end.
Go on. I just wanted to add to that as well, because from what Dan mentioned there, it's fantastic that we can get information like that from our contractors that have all the material costs and the challenges with sourcing materials as well. But from my experience and the organisations that I work with, the data that's coming in from suppliers and contractors, it can vary. And I think a lot of the time, issues with contractors around response times, the quality of work, as well as customer satisfaction, it needs to be collected and analysed just to assess the performance of the contractors, because more often than not, the quality of data coming from contractors is below the standard required to help actually inform the decisions and have an impact just on what Dan was saying.
Let's move on, though, and talk a wee bit more about tenant satisfaction, because I think traditionally it's been an annual or even a triannual survey of tenants to find out what they think of your service. How does Berwickshire Housing Association do this, Dan? I mean, there is a theory that it should be continuous. You should be asking customers all the time what they think.
That's how we do it, Jimmy. What I would say is, and this might be slightly contentious, but a regulator expects us to do perception surveys once every 3 years. My view, and I do, I feel like, are our customers experiencing services the same way they did 3 years ago today? Would be my first question on that. So if we aren't doing it continuously, then what value is that really placing in terms of how much value should you place in a survey that you took 3 years ago in and around COVID, in terms of the operating landscape that we presently have to work within? So that would be my first observation. We do capture it monthly. It's independent, or it has been independent, through a company called Knowledge Partnership. It was a minimum of 40% return, so we would on average capture about 720 surveys across 1,900 homes a year and customers a year. And Yeah, the data has been really informative. Jonathan Cox, again of Housemark, had a really interesting article about how the methodology and the approach to capturing customer satisfaction can actually dictate the response that you get. So I think he inferred that if you're using online only, then you could realistically expect a 15% drop in terms of the satisfaction. Now, what I would say is that we'll always look at it in terms of what the customer demand is and making sure that it's as impartial and that the anonymity is retained so that we can get, you know, a real validation of the authenticity of the return. And that's, you know, I don't think that's for 1 second what Jonathan was saying, but what he was suggesting was that you need to have more, you need to have a multitude of platforms, but you also need to have recognition that the platform that you use may dictate a different response. What we try and do is ask open questions beneath the 7 statutory satisfaction questions so that we can get a bit of substance beneath it. For me, data can either be one, it can either, rich data can either inform something or it can validate something. But what we do here is we ask the questions and then we get to pull at threads with the open questions to say, so are you satisfied with the management of your neighborhood? No, not particularly, or no, dissatisfied. We can then ask an open question that then reflects, well, what would that be? Or what is it that you would expect Berkshire Housing Association to do that would make you satisfied with that? So yeah, we're developing all the time and we always go back and review this regularly, but it's something that we've come to do monthly. We do it monthly now and it's cumulative for the year.
And another kind of related question. You set up a project called Be Well, and it's a partnership with Penumbra to support mental health and well-being of your tenants. How would a landlord know that you needed to do that?
Yeah, so, you know, this derived again from data, and it came from, if I'm being totally authentic, it came from the fact that our void loss was really high at 2.25%. Our relet times were really long, and our tenancy sustainability was quite low as well from a percentage standpoint. So the trifecta of the three we put together and we said, what is the source of the issue? The source of the issue is that customers are not sustaining their tenancies, remaining within their homes. The source before that is we're not detecting their needs and we're not intervening. We're catching them at crisis point where the horse is already bolted, for want of a better word. So that's where that derived from. We're now at 0.6% on our void loss. We're at 23 days to let, and our tenancy sustainability is at 94%. And Be Well allows, we also do BHA Connect. So this is about the operating model thing again. Our neighborhood managers, equivalent to a housing officer perhaps, have patches of 250 homes. But we also have the BHA Connect is that they visit every one of those customers once within a year to 18 months. We've not landed on an exact kind of cycle on that. But the fact is we're getting in the door, first through the door, identifying the needs proactively, then being able to draw upon either statutory services in real severe cases or rely upon this partnership that we have with Penumbra, which has been fantastic. And an example I could give was we had a customer who had £5,000 arrears and was not engaging with social work and the care plan that they'd been given, had more or less lost trust with kind of institutional as they were services, and BHA were included in that. Penumbra went and started engaging on a very open book arrangement. So we didn't have prescriptive time. It wasn't a case of you get 2 hours with each customer, and it was, you know, if you need 16 hours, then you take it. Started working with them, that customer's sustained their tenancy, no longer in arrears, is actively participating and volunteering within the local community, and we have saved in the round probably what we invested in this project in the first place.
Brilliant.
Won a single mention.
Ewan.
Yeah, it does. Let's open this up to wider trends in the sector. And sticking with tenant satisfaction, there's certainly a perceived decline in tenant satisfaction rates. Is that correct? And if so, what's driving this?
Well, I think there's an article that Jonah, one of our data operations managers that Dan referred to earlier, was talking about a decline in the Scottish Quality Housing Standard. Now, we know that from issues that people have with their properties and that, you know, that they live in, it ultimately results in lower customer satisfaction. So yes, seems to be in the round. Now, a lot of this was down to the interpretation, and as Dan mentioned, is how often that information is being collected, or is what the providers are doing with that information that actually makes a difference on the ground. And Jimmy, you mentioned it as well about, you know, having continuous feedback. It's the continuous feedback loop that's absolutely critical. And it ensures that the tenancy satisfaction data is regularly collected, is analyzed, and it's used to drive ongoing improvements. By systematically monitoring tenant satisfaction and taking prompt actions based on the data, you know, we can create a culture of continuous improvement and responsiveness, which is going to lead to sustained increases in tenant satisfaction levels.
Last question then. Housing association boards are run by lay people, like me, actually. I'm a member of a board of a housing association, and they have to take big decisions on development and retrofitting and rents, evictions and borrowing millions of pounds, all on the advice of their officers. So as we collect more and more information, how can we ensure that decision makers are not simply overwhelmed by data?
Can I start, Sam? Okay, so one of the things I think, and this is maybe slightly detracts from, you know, what Housemark doing around the data thing, is I think we need to maybe just diversify the way that we present information in the boardroom. So prime example, Jimmy, is we've got a customer voice group of 16 interested customers, and this is, you know, we're actually, it's not a constituted registered tenants organisation, it's a very informal arrangement, but people tend to come back because they're enjoying influencing and shaping what we do. But what we are quite keen to do is actually just allow them to either, you know, in a more modern way, do a video that records and summarises what they've discussed and what their recommendations are, and placing that in the boardroom. So this customer voice straight to the governing board. That's one way we can do it. But I also think that a lot of the stuff we do, we can give visual representation to. So I think a lot more visuals and, you know, infographic information helps, alongside case studies as well. Case studies which are, you know, more qualitative in terms of the impact, some of the fuel foundation stuff and some of the fuel poverty fund work we've done, some of the most profound and impactful things that really validated that work and that effort was around the case studies, the individual case studies we were able to demonstrate to the board. So that's just a couple of suggestions. Daz will no doubt have many more.
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise a really good point, and it's around the visualization of the information that's being presented, and it needs to be to the right people at the right time. And a lot of this is down to data literacy, because it does empower housing providers, policymakers, and stakeholders to understand and interpret that data effectively. And by developing organization-wide data literacy skills, we can make informed decisions based on the evidence and insights derived from housing data. Now, this includes understanding key metrics and analyzing trends. So techniques such as charts, graphs, and maps, they can help decision makers, you know, visualize patterns and see the relationships with data. And I think ultimately, data literacy equips housing providers with the skills to effectively communicate and advocate for policy changes, resource allocation and support services. And by analyzing and visualizing data on the challenges, tenant outcomes and the benefits of sustainable tenancies, providers can make evidence-based arguments for policy reform, increased funding or sector-wide improvements.
Excellent, guys. Well, you've convinced Jimmy and I. Let's hope we convince a few of our listeners. That brings us to the end of this episode. My thanks to Daz Chohan and Dan Blake from Housemark and Berwickshire Housing Association. My thanks to Jimmy Black, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks.